And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
This is the first official alert to the people of the Earth. Your planet is under attack. The life forms, including yourselves, are heading into a phase of dramatic change. It is already underway. As a matter of fact, it is well underway. The changes you are seeing in your climate, your weather, your oceans, and land have been warning you for years. You just may be entering the twilight zone of life. Please pay attention and make plans to do what needs to be done. Stay where you are. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Over the past 2.5 years, the Wildside News has brought you reports and conducted interviews with an incredible array of scientists, scholars, advocates, activists, in an effort to follow the trends that emerge in nature and the environment. As you know, the archives are filled with the greatest voices of the earth, people who are doing the fieldwork, conducting the research, compiling the numbers, and tracking the changes. And during this time, the voices are sounding an ever more ominous warning that things are going very wrong with the living systems. And though the Wildside News has tried to shy away from alarmist rants and rhetoric, a time comes when the truths converge into a sense of the moment, and that moment is now. This is the first official declaration of the impending threat to our living systems. In our first segment, I will be detailing this declaration. Please listen carefully. In our second segment, we'll be talking with Dr. Jeremy Jackson, who works with Scripps Institution of Oceanography, who has been conducting research on an amazing myriad of oceanic factors and has announced recently that a serious collapse is taking place in the oceans right now, that the vastness is now replacing the once flourishing diversity of fish and mammals and corals and phytoplankton, all thrumming in a dance of life, with a downtrending simplification of form. And with the losses of a large species, the oceans are filling with something resembling the original oceans in which life evolved. That primordial slime is taking over. In segment 3, we head on out to New Mexico and talk with Bill Shudlick, who is committed to keeping the historic wilderness free from oil and gas leases because he loves to catch cutthroat trout, and his friends like to hunt, and others love the open vastness of the Grand Valley that is Valle Vidal. It's all coming up, but as always, we begin with the news. The heat wave that gripped California for 2 weeks, causing 136 deaths, is on the move and is currently cooking people from Chicago to Cleveland. With temperatures stuck at around 100 degrees all over the eastern half of the nation, record demands are stressing local and regional power supplies. Lights are dimmed in the evenings in New York and the nation's capital, where the heat is expected to continue through Friday. The third tropical storm of the season is lumbering around the Caribbean, trying to decide if it's going to deliver a big punch to Florida and the Gulf states, or leave it up to another celebrity storm. Experts are predicting another challenging hurricane season, as water temperatures in the Gulf remain at record high levels, which are the driving force that whips a sleeper storm into a twisting tyrant. Oil rigs in the Gulf are also watching which way the wind blows as the Senate approves an offshore drilling bill that could see hundreds more oil rigs popping up along the Gulf Coast. The House version of the bill would open up offshore drilling from New England to Alaska. The controversial bill now moves to Senate and House negotiators for a compromise draft. The war raging between Israel and Lebanon resulted in a massive oil spill along the Lebanese coast that threatens hundreds of miles of coastline and is expected to take many months to clean up. It is Lebanon's worst environmental crisis. The spill came after Israeli planes bombed a Lebanese power plant, dumping 15,000 tons of oil into the eastern Mediterranean. Depending on the winds, the oil spill could affect beaches in Turkey, Greece, and Cyprus. A serious oil spill occurred along one of Russia's largest export pipelines near the border with Ukraine and Belarus. Conflicting reports about the extent of the spill vary, but some say as much as 4 square miles have been affected by the spill. The European economy is also in conflict, as reports vary about the possible slowdown of imports to Europe, which receives 1/8 of their oil from the Russian fields. The price of oil worldwide took a jump back up, as reports from the spill and insecurity in the Middle East continued. China announced that over the last 5 days, the Yunnan province carried out the slaughter of 50,000 dogs in an effort to quell an apparent outbreak of rabies. Of the 200,000 residents, 360 suffered dog bites in 2005, of which 3 people died. The response was particularly brutal, as killing teams spread out and snatched dogs from owners and killed them immediately with clubs. And scientists have taken a stand for evolution, claiming that the bird named after the discoverer of evolution, the Darwin finch, has exhibited an evolutionary change within just 20 years. The Darwin's finch has a beak which is exactly the right size to eat a specific-sized seed. A recent immigrant began outcompeting the Darwin's finch for the seed sources, at which point the Darwin's finch evolved its beak into a smaller form, thus permitting it to feed on smaller seeds. Conclusion: evolution is alive and well. And that's the news. This is your first official alert. We humans go through life minding our business, doing what we do, until, that is, a siren sounds. We hear them each day on the news, in Lebanon and in Israel, as air raid sirens sound to warn the population of an impending missile attack. And we've seen the brutal results for those who ignored the sirens' warning. Many people in small towns across America and around the world hear sirens to tell them of a potential tornado. It means take cover in your basement on the wall facing the storm. In years past, every community in America had a civil defense siren that beckons citizens to head to their civil defense shelters immediately for protection and to tune in to the emergency radio broadcast frequency and to follow the directions provided. We all know that when a siren sounds, it means it is time to stop whatever you are doing and take protective action. In that spirit, the Wild Side News sounds its first living defense siren. This is your official warning that the ongoing attacks on the air, on the land, and the sea are getting worse, and that critical measures must be taken immediately to protect yourself and your family from possible harm. The warning is based on the collective intelligence reports from scientists, researchers, and the public at large that various areas around the world are facing potentially catastrophic change. In many areas, the loss of life has already reached alarming proportions. Reports from the field indicate that 90% of all large fish are gone. Continued overfishing combined with bottom trawling is severely damaging the homelands of the remnant populations. Toxic chemicals are attacking shorelines and creating vast areas where life as we've known it has been exterminated and is being replaced with massive bacteria and algae broths, which are fatal to native species and can cause serious health risks in humans. Local residents are encouraged to take action immediately to turn this deadly tide that is engulfing large areas along the Gulf and eastern states. Meanwhile, the air attack continues from the unseen and odorless carbon and oxygen mixture that is bringing about severe changes in weather patterns, resulting in killer heat, crop-destroying droughts, and the elimination of water sources upon which whole societies depend. Long-term effects could see coastal cities devastated by rising ocean levels. People living in remote island communities are already being forced to flee the rising waters. Global citizens are warned to be especially aware that some members of their communities are suffering dramatic and near catastrophic genocide already. Due to germ and toxic attacks, frogs, salamanders, and the entire class of amphibians may witness a mass extinction. Any animals dependent on amphibians are warned to seek alternative food sources if available. And communities suffering already from the loss of amphibians are warned to be prepared for significant rises in insect populations, which could result in greater incidence of West Nile virus. Citizens are encouraged to take immediate action to assure adequate water supplies as drought, early snowmelt, and melting glaciers are posing extraordinary risks to areas which rely on food crops and water for their survival. Remember that humans can survive for only 3 days without water. The population is also being advised to prepare for more frequent and longer-lasting record heat waves as the effects of the attack on the planetary air systems is being felt worldwide. Humans who rely on such food sources as beef, chicken, and hogs should be particularly cautious to have alternative food sources available, as animal food sources can be severely impacted by long-sustained heat. An added danger arises to both livestock and humans, as electric power systems are not operating at maximum levels. Failures this past week have resulted in the deaths of hundreds of humans and thousands of livestock in the U.S. alone. Global insecurities are also threatening oil supplies and threats to the economies of oil-dependent countries, which is already being felt in increasing deaths from armed conflicts around the world. Tensions between competing nations are pushing the global family of nations to the breaking point. All citizens are encouraged to become aware of any immediate dangers and take necessary actions to prevent loss of life and relieve suffering. Civil defense networks are forming around the world, and all citizens are encouraged to find them and seek their assistance and to actively volunteer their time and resources to defend all life on Earth. Failure to take immediate action will only accelerate the chaos, suffering, and death of the Earth's inhabitants. Citizens must prepare for a long and difficult battle against the forces which threaten the very existence of life as we've known it. However, it is a battle for life itself. It is a time for every man, woman, and child to struggle on to victory, for peace is possible, but only if you act now. This concludes the first Earth Alert on your Voice of the Earth here on the Wild Side News.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
As we speak, the question of evolution is being debated in Congress and in classrooms across America. But while the debate continues, the world is beginning a process of devolution, as higher and higher forms of life disappear from the land, the sea, and the air. the vacuum being replaced by ever more primitive forms of life. Nowhere is the change more evident than in the oceans. You're about to enter the slimy world of oceanic devolution. Don't go away. The Los Angeles Times this week has featured a five-part series on the oceans. Years of research have led to the series, written by Robert Weiss. I nominate it for a Pulitzer right now. The picture is at best grim. The series uncovers some very painful and disturbing truths about where the oceans are headed. I encourage all of you to track the links which I've posted on today's show page and read the full series. One of the researchers featured in the series is about to tell you about this devolution taking place in the oceans. Let's listen in now. This week in the LA Times has been a front page feature running 5 days featuring the plight of the oceans, and it's one of the more incredibly effective in-depth discussions of this topic, particularly in such a mainstream media and on the front page. It's exciting to see, although it is very, in many respects, depressing. One of the players who has participated in this particular story and is featured, as a matter of fact, is a scientist, researcher, educator, Dr. Jeremy Jackson, who is a professor of oceanography at the legendary Scripps Institution of Oceanography. Dr. Jackson, welcome to the Wild Side News. First of all, give us a little background in the focus of your life's work. Your forte is in paleobotany and macroevolution. Why don't you tell us how that factors into the story that's evolving now?
More paleontology, not really paleobotany. I was trained as a paleontologist and as an ecologist at Yale University a long time ago, and my interests were in how changes in environments over time drive major patterns of ecology and evolution. I certainly didn't have any initial interest in human impacts on the environment, and frankly didn't think about them very much. I think that the reason I've been drawn into these issues, other than the fact that as I've gotten older, I've seen changes happen that upset me, is that as a paleontologist, I'm trained to think historically and over longer timescales than most biologists do. And that's equipped me to look at patterns and over the larger scale. My father was an historian, and I grew up hearing all about the Caribbean and the way it was in the 16th and the 17th centuries, when people were simply blown away by the extraordinary abundance of animals like turtles and sharks and sea cows and enormous fishes. And really, almost from the beginning of my career, when I went out to actually collect data on my own, what was really striking was that none of those things that I'd heard about in the past were really there. I did my PhD dissertation on the ecology of the mollusks, the clams and snails, that live in environments that we call turtle grass beds. And in the 4 years that I did that research, I never actually saw a turtle in the turtle grass bed. So it was fairly stark. What took more time was to realize just how important those losses were. You know, the seagrass beds looked healthy and the coral reefs looked healthy, but they weren't. And then when subsequent perturbations happened and the systems didn't recover, then all those creatures that were missing took on
I know that that's one of the areas that Scripps is really focused on, some researchers are, and that is the fact that when we talk about the changes in the ocean over the last 50 years, we're starting at a broken point already.
Well, that's right. This is the notion that the great fisheries biologist Daniel Pauly developed. He calls it shifting baselines, and the term comes from the fact that any environmental scientist tries to set what we call a baseline of what the pristine condition was. The problem is, though, that everybody thinks that the way the world was when they were a kid or got started in something is the baseline.
Right.
And then the subsequent degradation that happens during their lifetimes is the problem. But of course, this phenomenon of shifting the baseline happens generation to generation to generation, and so what we accept as natural is really almost universally a pale shadow of what was there before.
Well, and even to the point of this discussion, and that is that, for example, young divers now who head into the oceans are seeing a world that is radically different than the world that, for example, you saw when you started diving.
It's when I was growing up as a kid, there were these programs like Sea Hunt on television with these big, enormous sharks. And when I started diving for my research, I kept looking over my shoulder, and then eventually I realized, well, there weren't so many of them.
Yeah.
And so the baseline was certainly dramatically shifted for me when I began my work in the 1960s. But in the 1960s, magazines like Skin Diver still showed underwater photographs of entire reefscapes. They don't do that anymore. They show close-ups of beautiful little fishes and sponges that might be 1 or 2 inches across. There aren't many beautiful reefs left to take pictures of, and so they just don't do it. And our whole standard of beauty and what we strive to see when we go underwater in the ocean has totally changed. And you know, we talk in the Florida Keys, people talk about the beautiful lime green waters, where they used to talk about the beautiful crystal clear blue water.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's amazing how people will adjust. And that's a huge problem, because it means that there's no perception of change, and then, you know, these things are cumulative and one thing follows on another, and then you get the one event that is the straw that breaks the camel's back, and everybody said, oh, nobody ever told me about what was happening. But of course they were talking about it, and
yes,
there's very little in those articles in the Los Angeles Times that's new. I mean, the power and the elegance of those articles is to pull it all together.
Absolutely.
But this isn't new news.
Well, that is part of the sad truth for people like you and me and probably everybody who's listening right now. And that is that we've watched and been part of these warnings. We've heard them for years and years and years, and no one's paid attention, which is what has led to this, is some form of ignorance and greed and many other factors. It went ignored.
Well, I think that, you know, most people try to make a living, and I think that, you know, out of sight, out of mind, there's a lot more interest in tropical rainforests because they're easier to come to grips with and understand, and tragically, actually, rainforests, for all the problems they have, are not in as much trouble as coral reefs are around the world. But it's much more difficult to understand that. I think that, you know, there are small groups of people whose livelihood genuinely depends on the oceans, and obviously they're not wildly enthusiastic about being told they can't fish for 5 years or do this or do that. And then on the other hand, in particular, the articles in the Times focus mostly on pollution issues. issues and things like the formation of dead zones, and it's pretty abstract for a farmer in Minnesota to make the connection between using too much nitrogen fertilizer on her fields and the consequence 2,000 miles down the Mississippi River in the Gulf of Mexico. So I think, you know, and to be fair, the important thing is more to look towards the future than to dwell on the past. And now that we are coming to really accept the magnitude of these changes, the important thing is what we're going to do about them in the future.
Well, let's give a perception of really what we're talking about here. From my perspective, I'm prepared to say they are in radical decline. I'm prepared to, at this point, say they're really in crisis. And unfortunately, when you go to the ocean, everything looks the same as it did 10 years ago in many areas.
And fish are still cheap because we, as the wealthiest nation in the world, we're able to fish out and make agreements and fish out and consume at still relatively low prices, fish from all over the world. If you go into a Costco and you look carefully at where the fish came from, very, very little of the fish that we eat in this country actually comes from the waters of the United States. So it hasn't hit us in the pocketbook with the severity that it's going to pretty soon.
Well, the specific area that I'd really like for you to address, and this is the concept of the rise of slime, and that sounds disgusting, but it is, quite honestly, but I'd really like to talk about the science, what has led to that. It's a whole combination of things.
It's really pretty simple to think about. And the analogy I like to use is think about a swimming pool in somebody's backyard, and you know, the water turns green and slimy and disgusting. And why does that happen? Well, it can happen basically for one of two reasons. Either, you know, the person is really sloppy and allows mud, rainwater, and junk to get into the pool, or the other reason is that the filter breaks. And exactly the same sort of two-part situation exists in the ocean. The farmer in Minnesota or Iowa or wherever who is using lots of fertilizer and plowing deeply is generating a lot of runoff of nutrients and sediments that flow down the river and get to the ocean, and those nutrients fuel population explosions of microscopic algae that we call phytoplankton that make these dead zones.
I think the important thing there for people who haven't had a chance to really think about this is the fact that those aren't, as you say, they're nutrients. There are animals and plants that absolutely thrive on that, and that's part of the beginning of the problem.
All life does. I mean, we put fertilizer on fields of corn or wheat so that we can have more corn and wheat, and in an exactly similar way, nutrients are good, and in past environments in most places were limiting resources for the growth of plankton, and the problem is when you have too much of it. But the other side of the story is that there were natural filters in the ocean, organisms that removed the phytoplankton, the microscopic algae, in great abundance. Those filters were things like oysters and clams and certain kinds of fish that consume absolutely extraordinary amounts of material in the water. The Chesapeake Bay was full of oysters that were so abundant that they broke the surface at low tide. They were hazards to navigation. They were charted in great detail in the middle of the 19th century, and it took almost 100 years to fish out all the oysters. We can calculate that those oysters filtered the equivalent of all the water in the Chesapeake Bay, which is the biggest estuary in the United States, in only 2 or 3 days, and they really filtered it. They they filtered that water so clean that they removed almost all of the phytoplankton production, the production of these microscopic algae on a daily basis. But, you know, we fished them all out. They aren't there anymore. There's almost no oysters left in the Chesapeake Bay. And so you have this double threat. You have, on the one hand, all these excess nutrients flowing down to the sea and fueling population explosions of these microscopic plants. And on the other hand, the organisms that used to keep them in check, that used to regulate the abundance of these microscopic plants, have also been removed. And this 1-2 punch has been catastrophic. And the consequence is what we call dead zones, and they're mushrooming, appearing all over the coastal zones of the world, the Baltic Sea, the Chesapeake Bay, Pamlico Sound, the northern Gulf of Mexico, the northeastern Gulf of Mexico. These are places where there are just extraordinary population explosions of microscopic plankton occurring. Organisms become so abundant that they can't be consumed, so they simply die. As they die, they rot. That uses up all the oxygen. There's no oxygen left on the bottom. That means all the animals die, and we end up with a mess. We end up with what I call the rise of slime, which is essentially population explosions of jellyfish and bacteria. And in these places, the shrimp die, the fish die, and literally the only fisheries that survive are jellyfish.
Mm-hmm. It's quite an image, because also when we think about the entire ocean, we realize that 90% of the large fish are pretty much gone at this point. And so
that's 90% of the fish that still were around in, say, 1950.
Right.
And there are many of the great fish like bluefin tuna that used to extend as far north as Alaska or into the Baltic Sea that stopped extending that far north 100 or 200 years ago. So the distributions of some of the largest and most important fishery species had been truncated long before those modern fisheries data began to be collected that gives us that 90% of the big fish are gone number. This is stuff that's been going on for a very long time, although of course it's increased in intensity and efficiency dramatically in the 20th century.
Well, because I'm a very visual person, I visualize this, and what I see is a very thin ocean. What I mean by that is very little large life. It's being transplanted by the microscopic.
Well, basically, what we're doing is we're removing all the big animals. When Columbus sailed from Spain to the New World, there were several species of animals swimming around in the North Atlantic Ocean that were a lot bigger than his ships. Hmm. It's a pretty rare thing to see animals like that anymore, and they're incredibly reduced in their abundance. We're also essentially deforesting the seafloor. We drag enormous heavy trawls over the bottom to catch groundfish and scallops and shrimp, and essentially we're turning what were very complicated landscapes into level parking lots. We're introducing species all over the world, sort of homogenizing the biota. We're making it warmer. We're dumping huge amounts of toxin. And the result of all of this is this rise of slime phenomenon. And, I mean, you can joke about it. I like to talk about, you know, you could imagine an environmental disaster film titled Escape from Malibu, where the only people who would live in a great place like that would be the people who couldn't afford to escape to somewhere like Minnesota or Wyoming, which would be away from the ocean. And the only people who live there would be the people who couldn't afford to move, because the health hazards and the unattractiveness of this slimy shore would be so great that nobody who could afford better would live there. And that's already happened in some of the most beautiful stretches of coast, on the west coast of Florida, where these toxic blooms of algae are harming people's health, causing massive outbreaks of allergies, emergency rooms filling up with people who have extreme asthma and stuff like that. It's already happening, and one has to hope that articles like these really terrific articles in the LA Times are going to make more people wake up to what is going on.
There was a long time when people really didn't think we could affect the oceans. I guess the baseline point here is that we're absolutely wrong about that. That we're dramatically
The solution to pollution is not dilution, because even the vast oceans are being markedly changed in their composition, because there's so many people and we produce so much garbage, and be it chemical garbage or literal garbage or nutrient garbage, and we're essentially flushing it down the toilet of the ocean, and you know, septic tanks fill up, and that's what's happening.
There are coastal areas
along the west coast of Florida.
Yes.
Barrier islands, they look almost wild. Spectacular beaches. Low population densities.
Paradise.
And paradise. And these dead zone phenomena are making them unattractive places to live. They close down beaches. They cause outbreaks of illness among people who move to these places to get away from the rat race or to retire. It's their, you know, their dream home, their little Shangri-La, and these phenomena are already ruining their lives.
Well, it's a real fact. It's destroying values of property. People can't live there. Health is being dramatically affected. This is not stories of things happening in the future. It's happening right now.
It's happening right now. Not everywhere right now, but it is happening right now.
Let's talk about this concept of the slime blooms, we'll call them, these massive areas that are affecting particularly coastal areas. I don't know to what degree they're
still essentially coastal, and there are large stretches of the coast where there's lots of mixing, lots of strong currents, or just very exposed areas where you hardly know anything happened. The tendency for these buildups to occur is obviously much greater in enclosed areas like estuaries and bays, or places like the Gulf of Mexico, where there's enormous runoff from huge population centers into relatively restricted water bodies. But as the amount of runoff increases and populations increase, then we're going to see the increase in size of these areas. And it's certainly conceivable that they will extend to occur essentially along the coastlines of most of the world.
One of the things that concerns me, I'm a biologist myself, and we all know that certain types of organisms, when they decide it's time to grow and they find the right situation to grow into, they do so very quickly. A perfect example of that is one day you're feeling fine, and then you're exposed to a cold, and the next thing you're feeling miserable within a day. And my concern that I'd like to hear your thoughts on, once these things gain a hold, how fast do they spread? I mean, is it the type of thing where these things can spread very quickly? Because
I mean, organisms that are very small, like your analogy of the cold, tend to divide very rapidly, so their populations can increase enormously. There have always been balloons of toxic algae. They happen right here off of Scripps most summers. The question is the frequency of these events, and quickly increasing. So under the right, or you might say wrong, combination of circumstances from our perspective, the environment becomes highly favorable for the explosive growth of these microorganisms, and in a period of a few days or weeks, they build up to enormous populations, and sometimes these blooms are so big that they extend, say, from the mouth of the Mississippi River to the Mexican border. So that's a really big area, and when they and many of these species are toxic, and so they have a very harmful effect on fish. And in some cases, some of the species, when they come ashore, if, you know, from wave action and wind and all the rest of it, the stuff gets into the air, then we get very dramatic human health effects, which is what happens off the coast of Northwest Florida.
I've done some research, but I certainly don't have the background that you do in terms of, as you say, there's two factors. One would be the frequency, the other would be the length. And based on my preliminary research, some are suggesting that the frequency is actually increasing quite dramatically, and then as well the duration, such that therefore life on the ocean beaches, coastal areas in the future here could become absolute, for long stretches of time, almost uninhabitable.
In a place like California, where there's very strong California current and an awful lot of mixing, there are probably other things that are a lot more important to worry about than dead zones. But along the east coast of the United States and on the Gulf of Mexico coast of the United States, this phenomenon of, or say in San Francisco Bay, this as an enclosed area, this dead zone phenomenon is really a big deal, and it's a problem that is increasing in importance at a very, very fast rate.
It's achieving critical mass at this point. It's in some areas, and I guess maybe that therefore the question becomes, where are we in this curve?
Well, you get to the point where people understand, you know, it's not like people are going to disappear from the planet or anything like that. It's just that the impact on the quality of our lives will, I believe, increase fairly dramatically. And I think then, you know, more and more people will begin to pay attention. And the solutions, on the one hand, are obvious, but on the other hand, they're really difficult. It's like global warming. I mean, I think we're getting to the point where finally everybody gets it that the reason we're getting the buildup of CO2 and warming of the climate is because of the burning of fossil fuels. Okay, what do you do about it? I mean, we're not going to stop driving cars tomorrow. People couldn't get to work, and they couldn't make a living, so that's just unrealistic. And by the same token, you know, we want to have corn and wheat to eat, and we need food, so we're not going to stop growing food. What we need to do is to start to take these things a lot more seriously and put a lot more energy and pay into figuring out ways to change the ways we move around and to change the ways we grow food so that we minimize the damage that we do in the process. And there are a lot of sort of obvious ideas to pursue, but it's not simple and it's going to take time.
It makes me think of the situation in New Orleans and Katrina, where people just sort of imagined that it could never really happen, and then it did, and then guess what? We really had no capacity to deal with the dilemma. I'm concerned that we may be sort of facing some times ahead where that may be the reality.
I think that's, I'm concerned about that myself, and I give very frequent public lectures about this sort of stuff, and it's difficult to grasp, and you know, if you haven't ever been in a maximum strength hurricane, it's a little difficult to imagine what it's like. And we know that there will be a very, very, very strong earthquake in California sometime in the next 10 years or so. And we know that the likelihood of extreme damage and loss of human life is very great. But, you know, if you haven't been through it or if you can't really imagine an alternative, it's hard to think of what you're going to do about it. Slowly but surely, we will, as a society, learn how to think more constructively about risk and about problems for the future and act more effectively. We're really only just beginning to understand these things.
Let's think out, you know, 10, 20, let's say that nothing happened. No changes happened. And I'm with you. I'm a political realist. Change is obvious. There's obvious things that we should be doing, but the reality
of... If we don't do anything in 20 years,
yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
Let's just say that the big ship doesn't turn, and we kind of keep on going as we typically do, and that's just what society does at this point. It's very difficult to really make significant societal change. I kind of doubt that.
But, you know, we do respond. I mean, I'm old enough to remember what really bad air pollution was like.
That's very true.
And every time there was a really bad London fog or something, you know, lots of people would die. That's why we have a Clean Air Act. I mean, eventually it got so bad that we responded. And in the same way, I think that the situation in the oceans will get so bad that we'll start to do something about that too, you know? I mean, it's just going to take time. And how long it'll take, well, obviously, I hope it'll take less time, but it might take longer.
Dr. Jeremy Jackson with the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. Actually, you've discussed some scenarios in 50 years from now that we may be facing a time when large-scale life in the ocean is destined to become almost obsolete. We'll talk about this again sometime. I think I'd like to continue this discussion. You have a lot to offer. Quickly, what are three things that people could do in the next 5 years?
Well, first of all, they ought to find out for all environmental issues. They ought to develop a little bit of basic knowledge because these things are going to affect their lives in the future. And people have to take the time to stop and think about stuff like this, especially when it gets laid in front of them as elegantly as it has been this week in the LA Times.
Yes.
The second thing they ought to do is just ask what about the way they live and the things they buy and consume can they change that might actually make a difference. And then the third thing they ought to do is ask questions about the people they vote for and whether or not those people they vote for are taking these issues seriously. And if they're not, then they ought to show their displeasure in the way they vote.
Well, Dr. Jeremy Jackson, I know that you've got some things to do, so I'm going to let you move on. Thanks so much for lending your voice here on the Wild Side News.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks a lot.
The changes are real, and many of you have not been directly affected by these realities. But the first thing we learned about nature is that it is so intricately interconnected. It's up to you. It's up to us. The time is now. When we return, we look at what is happening to American democracy when the people's will is pitted against the oil well. When your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool black skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming.
But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
What do 59,920 people all have in common? They want to keep their wildlands wild. They spoke out against the nine who favor natural gas exploration on a vast wild area in New Mexico called the Valle Vidal. It is a sign of the times. And we all know how these things have gone in recent times. Will the will of the people fill again? It's all coming up when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News. This last week, following the incredible decline in oil prices from the high of 80 down to 73, we're now seeing oil prices spiking up again as the instability on the planet just seems to keep on unfolding, which right now, this week, is before us every evening in the news. And it's unfortunate because this oil crisis, this oil future is and energy future is a huge looming question that's going to have to be resolved. And for those of us who feel this at the pump, it's one thing, but there are people who are feeling this from another perspective, and that is literally the fact that these oil resources are in their backyard, and in some cases, actually in some of their favorite backyard areas, and this can include, therefore, wild areas and public lands. It's been an issue, and it always will be, but there's a particular event that's happening now in New Mexico that is gaining some new press right now, and joining us to talk about this is Bill Shedlick, who is the chairman of the New Mexico Council of Trout Unlimited, joining us from Santa Fe, New Mexico. Bill, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Well, thank you, and thank you for having me.
Well, you're in a beautiful part of the world up there in New Mexico. I lived there for 25 years in Santa Fe itself. I happen to know that you moved to New Mexico from the Midwest. What do you think of New Mexico?
Oh, I love it out here. I don't know that I could move back east, that's for sure, or back to the Midwest.
One of the things that New Mexico has is tremendous open spaces, a real sense of the wild. Obviously, that's something that is very appealing to you.
Yes, it is. It's quite a bit different from Michigan, where whereas we had all kinds of water there. Out here, water is certainly an issue. So that's certainly different for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that is emerging right now is a controversy that relates to this whole issue of oil, the demand, not oil, excuse me, of energy resources. And this is happening over an area called the Valle Vidal, which is in northern New Mexico. Bill, you seem to have some sort of special interest in the Valle Vidal. Why don't you talk about it and what it is that interests you about that area?
Sure. The Valle Vidal is, as you said, it's one of our premier pieces of public lands here in New Mexico. It was acquired from Pennzoil back in 1981 and opened shortly thereafter as part of the Carson National Forest. It has some streams in there that are one of the last strongholds in our state for our state fish, the Rio Grande cutthroat trout, which has been, frankly, imperiled for many years. It's been petitioned twice for listing under the Endangered Species Act. And in my role with Trout Unlimited, we're trying to do the work here in New Mexico that's necessary to keep the fish from being listed, as we all want to continue to fish for it. And we really don't want to lose the Valle Vidal and lose the populations of Rio Grande cutthroat trout in the Valle Vidal, as we think they're important. And you know, if we lose those populations, we're that much closer to a listing.
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting because typically, when people are concerned about preserving a specific species of fish, the effort is to get them listed as an endangered species. You're approaching this kind of from a different perspective. Your interest is in keeping the population healthy so that you can use this as part of your recreation and your sport, And so it's just it's kind of an interesting dynamic. You're coming at this from a different perspective, but the ultimate aim is the same, and that is to restore and maintain a healthy fish population.
Well, yeah, and you know, this trout is part of the heritage of New Mexico. I think we all considered it that. The Puebloans fished for it many, many years ago, and the Spaniards fished for it when they came, and then the Anglos came and fished for it, and then they decided to replace it with some other fish, and that's caused all the problems. And Trout Unlimited is an organization that really likes to get work done on the ground. We don't like to play politics too much. We'd rather do the work on the ground, and we have the organization to do it, and we have access to grants and funds and volunteers to get that work done. So, you know, our objective is to keep this fish healthy and get it healthier, and we do want to fish for it. I mean, we're anglers. We like fishing.
Mm-hmm. From what I understand, the area that we're talking about, the Valle Vidal, one of the unique things about the Valle Vidal is the fact that this is one of the areas that still has this fish. And there, am I right about that?
Yes, it does. And in fact, our organization just secured some grant money to kind of restore and secure the populations in one of the rivers in the Valle Vidal, remove the non-native fish, and secure that Rio Grande cutthroat trout habitat so that they'll be there for future generations.
Let's talk about what it is about that area. It is considered a public land, and that's part of where the rubber meets the road in terms of this issue, because there are many people who want to keep this area open for many different purposes, hiking, camping, hunting, fishing, and just recreating, and keep it a road-free area. There's an interest in this area for other purposes that are at cross purposes with yours. Give us some history on that.
Sure. As I said, the Valle Vidal was acquired in '81 from Pennzoil Corporation, and it was interesting that at that time, the Carson National Forest, where the Valle Vidal is, was undergoing a plan revision for their forest, and they didn't incorporate the Valle Vidal into that plan revision. It was kind of too far along, I think, to get the Valle Vidal in there. So it's never been part of the forest plan, and right now they're going through a plan amendment process to include the Valle Vidal. You know, I think some of us believe that this is being spurred on by the interest of El Paso Corporation in acquiring the leasing rights for the eastern half of this property. And in this planning process, we just went through a scoping period in which people from New Mexico were able to comment on what their beliefs were about the Valle Vidal, what their feelings were about this place, how they interacted with the Valle Vidal. And in that comment period, the Forest Service received 54,029 comments, I believe, and 54,020 of those comments stated that these people did not believe that it should be open to coal bed methane development.
That's a little more than a majority.
I think it's 99.9%.
Oh,
but okay. there were 9 comments in favor of drilling. The Forest Service, in this process, it kind of told everybody that they did not want to deal with this drilling issue at all in this process. They wanted to leave that for a leasing decision. And that's kind of contradictory to what scoping is all about. In that process, you're supposed to be assessing what people feel are the important issues for that area. So we're waiting right now for the EIS to come out. But it's our impression that it's not going to deal with this drilling issue at all, and that's going to be left for a leasing analysis, which is a little disappointing to everybody involved with this.
If it goes to that point, then that decision could be made irrespective of the scoping process and all this overwhelming concern to keep this a natural area?
Well, I think that depends on who you talk to, but it certainly is possible that these comments could be ignored. I think my impression of a leasing analysis is that they're looking at what are the best ways to get a resource out of there, not necessarily deciding whether or not the resource is there. And you know, the resource analysis has already been done on the Bay of Adel, and there's about enough, there's enough gas under there to supply our nation for about 2.5 days. So, you know, we can get into these discussions about, you know, whether we have to do this to provide for our energy needs here in this country. But even if they got every ounce of gas out of the Bay of Adel, which would take them 20 to 30 years, it wouldn't change the equation at all. We'd still be in the same spot we are now.
Let's project out, and let's say that drilling were to go ahead. What is it that one would expect to see in that area? How would it change that experience or the land itself?
Well, if you're going to drill this, and I don't know, you know, if people have looked at maps, and they're out there on the internet, you can look at maps of some drilling areas around the West, and initially they'll start out with well pads about every 160 acres. And to get to those well pads, though, they have to build a network of roads. And eventually what they do when they've kind of exhausted the resource at a density of 160 acres, they try to downsize to like one well pad every 80 acres and then one well pad every 40 acres. And along with all those well pads go a corresponding network of roads and pipelines. And all those roads can potentially cause erosion. Those well pads cause erosion. There are, you know, you can't help but having some chemicals run off into the streams. And when they do drill for this coal bed methane, they also have to extract a large amount of water out of the aquifer because the gas is actually trapped in these coal seams, which are filled with water. And to get to the gas, they have to get the water out of there. So another concern of ours is that they would be dewatering some of these streams by removing a large amount of water.
Mm-hmm. Well, I suppose from the perspective of just literally maintaining a healthy fish population, that begins to be where there's a direct correlation between, you know, drilling for natural gas there and your specific interest in the cutthroat trout.
Absolutely, and you know, this is where we get into a direct connection between us wanting to keep the Rio Grande cutthroat trout population healthy enough to keep it from being listed, and the potential of oil and gas development, dewatering some of these streams and degrading these streams.
Give me a visual of the experience. I mean, is this a mountainous area? Is it a plateau? Is it a mixture of both? What is that experience like?
Well, the Bay of Adel means Valley of Life, and it is a very large alpine valley area. I don't know of any other areas within the Sangre de Cristos that are quite like it. It's wide open expanses. There aren't a lot of trees. It's a grassland. There are trees up on the hills. You know, there are some mountains in the middle of the area, but there are also these big wide open vistas, and you know, it is a great area for horseback riding too. People just love riding out there because you can see so far.
And that to me is where there's a direct impact. Because I believe that, for example, the wilderness or outdoor experience is vital for we humans. We have a right to that. And based on your description of this area, if you were to start to imagine wells every 160 or 80 or 40 acres, that would dramatically impact that experience.
Oh, absolutely. I don't know who would want to go horseback riding there, and it definitely does have an impact on the elk populations, too. They tend to move away from these areas, searching out areas where there wouldn't be well pads.
This brings together an interesting coalition of interests, because not only is it the fishermen, and it is, well, hunters and horseback riders and environmentalists, you're all beginning to really work for the same objective here.
Absolutely, and you know, this coalition has always been broad-based. There are 400 local governments, businesses, community groups, and conservation groups that have signed on to the coalition. And it's not really, you know, it's not a left or right issue here. This is more of a federal government versus the local people issue. I think we in New Mexico have made it clear that we don't think that there's enough gas there to warrant destroying one of our best public places. And yet it seems the federal government wants to impose this upon us.
You know, it's odd, without getting too political, but it seems as if the current administration is supposed to be a states' rights advocate, but when it comes to these particular issues, it seems obvious in this particular case that although 99.9% of the population who've had a chance to talk about this say, no, please leave this the way it is, the federal interests are overriding the state's interests, this just yesterday, today, sometime very recently, the House actually passed a bill unanimously to set aside the area and keep it protected from natural gas exploration.
That's correct. That happened on Monday. They did pass the Biovidal Protection Act out of the House, and so we're moving on to the Senate, and then hopefully to the President's desk.
Having lived in New Mexico and watching the politics from that area, you may have a difficult time in the sense that Senator Domenici is one of the strongest players when it comes to these particular areas. Any take on how he's looking at this issue?
Well, you know, first of all, I appreciate how tough a job he has there trying to balance the, you know, our energy needs in this country in a very tough time. But, you know, as I mentioned, I don't think this is an issue where if they get all the gas out of there, that's going to change the equation at all. To this point, though, Senator Domenici has been, I don't want to say sitting on the fence, but he's more interested in seeing this process, this Forest Service and leasing analysis process, work its way through the system. And we really don't believe that that system is a fair one in terms of protecting resources. It's more rigged towards the gas and oil industry and getting them in there and extracting these resources whenever possible.
Well, this is my personal commentary. I do have the sense that Senator Domenici really does a lot of bidding for that particular power structure. So you got perhaps you have your hands full a little bit in terms of trying to maintain the same protections in the Senate. It goes to the Senate, then what happens?
Well, if we can get it out of the Senate in the next couple of months before this Congress ends, I would hope that the President would sign it. He hasn't vetoed much in his tenure, so I hope he wouldn't feel like vetoing this.
Now, if it didn't get through the Senate, then what would be the future of this issue?
Then we would have to start over again. There are bills have been presented in the House and the Senate. Tom Udall's bill, which is the one that got out of the House, is the one we're working on now. But Senator Bingaman has also introduced a bill in the Senate to set up a Biovidal Preserve, which is a little bit more complex than I think the bill that got out. I'm kind of happy that the one that's going forward is going forward because it doesn't really set up any bureaucracy. It just removes the Biovidal from energy development.
Although this is a very localized issue within the state of New Mexico, it does require a national response, doesn't it?
I think that it does. I think that this is a kind of typical of what we're seeing around the Rocky Mountain West. And, you know, it's not just in New Mexico, but we've seen hunters and anglers and typically conservative groups kind of rise up against us a little bit now. We're starting to see more and more of it on the Rocky Mountain front, Rhone Plateau in Colorado, because, you know, it does get back to this the state's rights thing that I think you mentioned earlier. And, you know, what do we want? As conservative people, we tend to like having more control at the local level than at the federal level, and this is kind of swinging the other way.
It's an unusual turnabout in terms of issues for conservative and liberal, et cetera, and it really is playing out in the West in very complex ways. What would you recommend that people do to try to help you guys?
With the Biovidal, yeah, to write to their senators to tell them to vote for the Biovidal Protection Act when it gets there. It's out of the House now, and boy, that's what we really need. I mean, if people have been there, probably. Try and share your experiences with your senator on what this place is like, because we know they can't all get there and they can't all see how beautiful this is. Though I have gone to D.C. and tried to show some of the congressional offices what this place is all about.
What's the best way for them to track your work through Trout Unlimited?
Through Trout Unlimited, you can go to www.tu.org, and in there you will see several menus. There's a conservation menu, which has within it the Public Lands Initiative, and that details a lot of the work TU has been doing in the Valle Vidal and around the West. You can also, for specifically the Valle Vidal, you can go to www.vallevidal.org. That's VALLEVIDAL.org. And there you'll get a sense of what we're working on and a sense of what this place is really like.
Well, I certainly want to support the people of New Mexico who've spoken clearly that they want to maintain this area. Because you live in Santa Fe and because you live in New Mexico, there's this little secret about that area, and that's the fact that there seems to be this almost spiritual ethic that permeates the air there. I think you know what I'm talking about. It probably has a lot to do with the just the native beauty of that area, the land of enchantment, as well as the ancient historic peoples who still live there, and as well the indigenous folks, the old Hispanic villages and towns that maintain their culture probably more intact than any other place in the United States. The hard question is, and this is a really hard one to answer, but I'd certainly appreciate your personal view on this, how are we going to maintain these values, these places for us, and how important is that to us? Whatever you want to share about that, because I think we can argue these things from an economic perspective or from the perspective of our future in terms of energy, but there's more to life than that.
Well, there certainly is, and you know, those things do come into play, but I think it's going to take a lot of hard work on the part of people who live in these places to try and protect and maintain them. We may have gotten away from that in the last few decades, but I think that era is over, and I think now we're in a place where local people are going to have to step up, and we're all going to have to negotiate with each other about how these lands should be used. But at the same time, I think it's important that we all get together and talk about these things and work through these issues before someone else comes in, like we're seeing here, and tries to impose upon us a set of beliefs that don't necessarily mesh with the local people.
Well, Bill Shedlick, I want to thank you so much for lending your voice here, and I wish you great success, and I count on me to try to keep the dialogue going.
Well, thank you very much.
You know, I love the earth and the wild creatures and the diversity of humanity that shares this great planet. And if I had my way, I'd talk endlessly about the spirit of the great elk, or the magic of morning bird call, or the gentle touch of wind on my soul as I stroll along the way. But right now, today, I must speak out in the defense of my earth. I thank you for indulging me in my passion, and long for a return to balance, peace, and wonder. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios. Until we meet again, each Thursday, or any time on the archives, when your voice of the earth continues, here on the Wild Side News.